All week, we've been thinking about borders. It's been hard not to when news stories bring us the sounds of families trying to make it from Syria to Greece or Hungary and farther north. Their stories are both so human, asking for protection and basic comforts, and also show the sometimes random nature of the lines we draw. Someone's fate is so intertwined with geography or category. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. So this is a show about borders, yes, the current news stories, but also the smaller ones that govern our everyday lives. You can come tell us how borders shape yours. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, write us on Facebook, or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to start our show on borders with the refugee crisis in Europe. This week, the White House announced that the U.S. will aim to take 10,000 Syrian refugees, like the tens of thousands of people fleeing the war there and in places like Afghanistan. This is the biggest migration on the European continent since World War II. These men were interviewed on the border between Serbia and Hungary as they made their way from Syria, telling stories that have become sadly familiar.
I'm coming from Syria because war, because not life, not good, not food, not water. Wife, dead. And my son. And my sister.
Europe's divisions over how to handle the situation have sparked intense debate. And this call from the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker for a united response.
No poems, no rhetorics. Action is what is needed for the time being.
Juncker has proposed a refugee resettlement plan based on countries' population and GDP, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But first, our partners at the BBC have this story from Hungary, where migrants have been crowded into train stations, thrown food by police, and leaders have been hostile to the EU plan. Thousands of refugees have been stranded in Hungary trying to make their way north, and the military is reportedly preparing a crackdown there. The BBC's Ben James met a man named Fikret, who owns the Istanbul Kebab House opposite the crowded Budapest train station.
We're watching some beautiful kebab meat roast on a spit. It's going round and round slowly. A beautiful smell. And is that hot sauce, chili sauce on top?
Arosh pishta mek paradishum van bana, paradishum pura.
So it's Arosh pishta is actually a Hungarian paprika sauce.
So the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, here in Hungary, has been talking about the kebab shops of Budapest as a symbol of Hungary, saying, you know, we don't have any problem at all with Islam in this current story of migrants and refugees. And what is it like being a Turkish guy, a Muslim in Budapest?
Thank you very much, Viktor Orban. I like Budapest very much. There's nothing wrong with Budapest. I do my job and I like being here.
All of the people that you've been seeing in the station across the road, they've been Syrians, Afghans, and people from Iraq as well we've met. Lots of them are going on to Germany. Most of them are going on to Germany and perhaps beyond. Do you think perhaps they should think about staying here?
So they're saying that they shouldn't really stay in Hungary because they can't make good money here. Business is not as good as it is in Austria and Germany because they are richer countries.
What brought you to Hungary in the first... Yeah, he's showing me his pockets. He's pulling his pockets out of his shorts and showing me that apart from a cigarette lighter, there's nothing in them at all. But what was it that brought you to Hungary in the first place, then?
I just came here.
No particular reason, you rocked up here.
I just came here. I just came here to work.
Do you hang out with Hungarians? Do you have Hungarian friends?
Vannak magyar barátaid?
Barátnő? Nincs.
Not girlfriend. Nem
barát. Barát, már magyar barátom, igen,
bar. Yeah, he's got Hungarian friends, but not a girlfriend.
So it's not that you hang out just with Turkish people, it's all mixed?
Afghan barátom van. Magyar barátom van.
I've got Afghan friends, Hungarian friends,
Kurdish.
Barátom
van.
Kurdish.
Igen.
I've got a friend from Germany who's here.
So if some people get the impression from outside that Hungary is not a welcome place for people from different countries, what would you say to them?
Excuse me.
He says, last week I saw there were 2,000 or 3,000 people here in this square outside Keleti station, and I saw loads of Hungarians coming up with sacks of food, clothes. They would even buy kebab from me, and they would give them straight to the refugees, to the migrants. So yeah, Hungarian people do help. They are sympathetic and they help the refugees.
Did they like your kebabs?
I like you need any ketosas.
One kebab cost 650. Some of the migrants came with 200 or 300. Of course, I gave them a kebab for 200 or 300. If they came with children, the children would get it free.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We played a little bit of a speech from the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, where he urged other European leaders to get behind a plan to resettle 160,000 refugees throughout Europe. It's pretty similar to a framework that our next guest put forth. His name is James Hathaway, and he directs the University of Michigan's program on refugee and asylum law. He says Juncker's plan, even with strong opposition from part of the continent, feels like a turning point in Europe's chaotic response to this crisis.
This was an amazing moment, and he said that there was a need for a managed response to the refugee crisis, that the sort of haphazard people trying to find asylum as best they could across borders had to end. And he put on the table a plan for 160,000 people within the EU to be effectively shared as among EU states, and indeed called for a more permanent plan that would have responsibility sharing as the norm within Europe rather than the sort of crazy system we've had in Europe for many years where whatever country you arrive in first, in this case, for example, Hungary or Greece, had 100% of the responsibility, which just doesn't make sense. And he said exactly that.
Yeah, I've read through some of your work, and you talk about that rule, what is it called, the Dublin Regulation, where,
that's right,
you know, the first place you land suddenly is in charge. So how exactly would this work, redistributing people to different countries?
Well, it's actually very similar to a plan that a group that I led 20 years ago devised, and we called it responsibility sharing. And the idea is that under the Refugee Convention, an asylum seeker doesn't have the right to stay in the country where she is able first to reach. She has a right to be protected as a refugee somewhere. And so the idea is to take advantage of the flexibility that is actually in the Refugee Convention to make sure that frontline states don't feel so overwhelmed that they close their doors, as, for example, Hungary did last week.
One of the things that I have found interesting looking at how these quotas might play out in different economies in Europe, the well-off countries with relatively, you know, positive GDP seem to be willing to do a lot more here. And so many of these stresses are falling on countries with little to no economic growth. How does the GDP part work?
Well, I think you're exactly right. And when the Chancellor of Germany said that Germany could absorb all of these refugees and many more besides, she was speaking, I think, from a point of view not only of humanitarianism, but from the point of view of enlightened self-interest. She knows she can read the demographic tea leaves. The social welfare structure in most of Europe is really in danger because of an absence of population growth. She sees, particularly in the Syrian migration, a lot of extraordinarily talented, well-educated professional shopkeepers and others who are precisely the people that Germany needs to keep its, you know, economy growing. So I think, you know, basically developed countries are not, in my view, as antagonistic to the idea of refugees arriving as they are sometimes portrayed to be. What they actually are is antagonistic to chaos, to a lack of management, to a lack of planning, to the sense that things are out of control. So when the president of the European Commission this week called for a managed approach in exactly the way that I've been speaking about for two decades now, I think what he is saying is that he understands that we can get more protection when countries feel that they're not being presented with a chaotic pattern.
How does the economics of this work out? Because if you look at the numbers, you know, the French say they're going to spend 6 million euros. Germany, about 6 billion. The EC saying, you know, almost a billion euros on relocation. Where does all this money come from?
Well, the truth is, I think we waste a lot of money in the current system. So standing back from the European scenario and working at the global level, which is where I tend to focus, we now spend at least $20,000 on average to assess one asylum claim in a wealthy country. We spend on average 50 cents a day to look after a refugee in a less developed country. Now, that's an equation that's not even on the ethical Richter scale. So the money is actually in the system, but at the risk of speaking against the interest of my professional colleagues, a lot of it is wasted on bureaucrats, on lawyers, on judges, on systems, rather than on actually protecting people. So what I've called for is a system that is run in the way, ironically, that it was run before the Second World War, with a single international agency that determines refugee status in a simplified fashion, normally on the basis of group status determination. You don't really need to ask a lot of questions of a Syrian arriving. I mean, you want to know who she is and that she's not a terrorist. But beyond that, we don't need to spend 6 hours interrogating her claim. You then have states recognize those certificates issued by the United Nations as the basis for protection, not necessarily where they arrive, but somewhere. And the dollars that we are presently spending to run a very fancy bells and whistles system can be reused in a different way to actually provide protection and the development assistance that would allow refugees to go home if and when conditions allow. The economists who worked with us on our model actually found that we could have an entirely new global system of protection for duration of risk with real quality protection and real assistance to refugees in the states that host them without spending $1 more than we spend today.
Jim Hathaway, director of the program in refugee and asylum law at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Now we're going to look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with a look at some of the other economic stories of the week. By the numbers. Tobin.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
90%.
That's about how much of the shrimp eaten by Americans is shipped from overseas.
When Asian and Latin American markets developed the technology to breed pathogen-free shrimp,
the global supply exploded, changing the supply chain of shrimp in the U.S.
$27.
That's how little per month you might pay for the latest iPhone.
If you buy it directly from Apple.
On Wednesday, the company announced a payment plan, a new thing for them, that lets customers pay for their phones in installments.
389.
That's the patent number held by TiVo for the technology to record, rewind, and replay live television.
Ownership of that little piece of tech is part of the reason TiVo continues to grow,
even as streaming content becomes more and more popular.
Okay, time for the Pretty Little Liars finale. I cannot wait.
I thought you watched it already. I deleted that forever ago.
Tobin!
You're a grown man. You are a grown man.
We're going to turn to state borders in the U.S. now and how they shape what we buy. One thing that comes up in the 2016 presidential race is health insurance, specifically buying and selling it across state lines. It's an idea very popular with several GOP candidates, and you'll probably hear about it at the Republican debate this upcoming week. Right now, most health care plans tend to only be available in one state or area. Margot Sanger-Katz writes about health care for The Upshot at The New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Why is this idea of selling health insurance across state lines so popular among Republicans?
I think that many of them feel that the market for health insurance could work better. And, you know, in so many other parts of our lives, having a national market in which products can be easily sold and purchased by people all over the country has been a really good way to keep prices low. And in health insurance, we have these sort of artificial boundaries where every state regulates insurance products differently, and so customers are limited in what they can buy. And so I think there's something inherently appealing about the idea of, why don't we take down these artificial barriers and allow people to purchase whatever they want and allow insurers to sell in whatever market that they want, and then without having to really get involved in the nitty-gritty of health insurance and the cost of health care, the market alone can help reduce the cost of health insurance.
I feel like if there's one thing we have learned in, you know, the time that we've seen the Affordable Care Act roll out, is that health insurance is a phenomenally complicated thing. And in a story you wrote about this, you sort of had all these quotes from slightly exasperated healthcare experts saying this is not really about state borders, but other forces in the way. What are the other forces?
So the main thing is that if you want to sell health insurance in a particular market, you have to have a contract with doctors and hospitals in that market who want to take care of your patients. So if you're a health insurance company in Utah, you might have great products to offer people who live in Utah. But if you want to suddenly sell that product to customers in Massachusetts, you're going to have to go over to Massachusetts and make a deal with the hospitals and doctors there so that you can get good prices so you can offer Massachusetts customers the same low prices that you offer your Utah customers. And it just turns out that's awfully hard to do. And that's the main reason why we do see a lot of regional health insurers that aren't selling insurance all across the country. Because if it was easy to make these business arrangements with healthcare providers everywhere, then even though they would have to deal with some of this annoying regulatory friction, they probably could set up shop everywhere. The real reason why we see this fragmentation of the health insurance market is because it's awfully hard to penetrate new markets where the existing insurers tend to have really close deals with the existing hospitals and doctors, and it's hard for someone new to get their foot in the door.
I mean, is there anything to the idea that selling across state lines might make things cheaper? I mean, are there any kind of analogs that have given us examples?
I think it's clear that it probably would reduce costs somewhat because there's just, you know, there's some overhead that's just associated with, you know, imagine you're an insurance company and imagine you even have deals with every hospital and doctor in every state of the country. It's still really annoying to have to learn the state laws and have regulatory relationships and file your rates slightly separately and send slightly different letters of notification to different customers in different places. And then there's a separate issue, which is that some states require health insurance to include many more services than other states do. So there are states where, for example, if you want to sell health insurance in the individual market, you have to cover bariatric surgery, you have to cover infertility treatment, you have to cover podiatry or chiropractic treatment. And then there may be other states where, prior to the Affordable Care, you didn't have to cover prescription drugs and you didn't have to cover the costs of maternity care and childbirth. And so, as you can imagine, that means that health insurance is a lot cheaper than in other states. And so by having a more national market, you know, so the idea goes, people could buy a product that is less regulated than the product in their state, and that might make it cheaper.
Do you think there's any chance that this would actually happen?
I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting is that this isn't really a federal legal problem. The real problem is that the states want to regulate their own products within their own borders. And so there have been a lot of efforts to encourage states to make deals with one another, either by having kind of regional insurance sales, or the Affordable Care Act sets up some incentives for states and for national carriers. And it doesn't seem inconceivable that there could be a federal law that would require this to be the case. But it just doesn't seem like the insurance industry is that interested in this. It's really not something that they've ever pushed for. There are some academics at Georgetown who a few years ago did a study of a handful of U.S. states that had passed laws saying, come on in, out-of-state health insurers, offer products in our state and we'll allow it. And what happened is that there were zero takers.
Wow.
The Affordable Care Act actually created something of a regulatory floor for all health insurance. So for the first time, there actually are some national standards. If you want to sell health insurance in any state, there are certain services you have to cover. And that didn't exist before. And so if we imagine a universe in which the Affordable Care Act continues to exist, then you don't have to worry about some of these race to the bottom concerns because all health insurance is going to be relatively uniform within a narrow band. But all of these Republican candidates who are talking about these across state lines plans also want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And so we almost have to imagine this universe before the Affordable Care Act passed, when there really was quite a lot of variation in what different states wanted to do.
Margo Sanger-Katz, who writes about healthcare for The Upshot at The New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
This next story about state borders and commerce, well, let's start with a song in tribute to it.
They were doing online at Floribama. That's the place we all go to unwind. Just a couple yards from good old Alabama. Everybody's doing it online.
The line in question is the state border between Alabama and Florida on Perdido Key in the Gulf Coast, where a very particular business sprang up in 1964, the Florabama. It sits on the state line, and back when it opened, you couldn't buy liquor in that part of Alabama. So walking over to Florida, very convenient. Nan Gibbs has been working there for 8 years and manages the liquor store. I asked her to describe the place to me.
Oh, the Florabama is a 5-star honky-tonk roadhouse beach bar.
So why does being on the border factor into the business in such a key way?
A lot of it has to do with taxes, liquor license, on how Alabama handles their alcohol rules and regulation, and same thing with Florida.
And what's it like inside the store? I understand that people really like to go see the line.
Yes, that is probably the number one question. Where's the line? Where is that line? They want to see it. They like to get their pictures taken at it.
How did you come to the Florabama in the first place?
Well, back in 83, when I was graduating high school, we were taking our family trips down here to the coast, and I'm originally from the Midwest area on another border state, being Wisconsin and Illinois. And we vacationed down here and just fell in love with it down here.
What are some of the slogans that have come and gone over the years at the Florabama? They're pretty great.
Probably our most famous was "Do it on the line," and it could be used with anything.
Indeed.
Party on the line, drink on the line.
The lottery is illegal in Alabama, so do you sell a lot of tickets on the Florida side?
Yes, we do. Lots. And lots and lots and lots.
What things are cheaper in Alabama and what things are cheaper in Florida?
Well, our liquor in Florida is cheaper because the state of Alabama is all run, their liquor is run by what is called the ABC board. On the Florida side, we get visited by vendors and are able to negotiate pricing, et cetera, with what we carry, you know, in our store.
So more of a free market system in Florida then?
Yes. Probably about 85% of our business does come from the Alabama and west of us.
What sells the best and how much does it sell for?
Well, our number one seller at our liquor store is probably Tito's Vodka, and we do very well with that. So well that in 2014 that the Florabama was the number one in the state of Florida for sales of that product. And then I think on the beach side, being the bar, the number one is our signature drink, the Bushwhacker.
Nan, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Borders show up, yes, between places and people, but also within organizations and companies. Journalist Gillian Tett calls them silos, and in her new book, The Silo Effect, companies like GM, BP, Sony, and almost all the big banks are cautionary tales about what goes wrong when expertise and isolation get in the way of common sense. And I guarantee you will read this book and find a dozen examples of how it applies to your own office or life. Gillian Tett is the U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with this moment in 2008 where Queen Elizabeth is at the London School of Economics.
You don't often get queens going to talk to economists, but hey.
And you have this great description of her saying, in her clipped upper-class vowels, "It's awful. Why did no one see the crisis coming?" This story, to me, crystallizes a lot of what is happening in your book. All of these smart people missing the point.
You're absolutely right. And the essence of my book is to look at a seemingly very simple question, which is, why do so many smart people in our world keep doing things that look incredibly dumb? And back in 2008, when the Queen went to London School of Economics, everyone was asking themselves, well, we have these brilliant economists. Some of the best economists in the world are at the LSE, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve. And yet somehow they were all shocked by the credit crisis and they were completely at a loss about what to do afterwards. So she was trying to figure out, why were they blind? And at the time, many people thought it was because somehow the bankers had fooled the economists. They had concocted a plot to hide what was going on. And what I argue is actually there's a much simpler explanation, and that is tunnel vision. Extreme tunnel vision and tribalism, if you like. You have a group of very highly paid, very highly respected economists and other policymakers who were so blinded by their own definition of what they should be looking at, and it was a very narrow vision, that they completely missed the real story.
The theme of our show this week is borders, and so I've sort of had that in my head as I was reading your book, but I kept thinking, you know, a lot of this stuff is pretty familiar to anyone who works in an office, who gets to the end of some project and is like, well, wait a minute, I didn't know that Bob was assigned to this, too. Is there some human reason we do this?
The simple human reason why we create these mental boxes, these borders, is because as a human species, we are completely overwhelmed all the time by data, by people, by processes, by ideas, by things. And we have to sort them out to create order. I mean, just think about your own house. If you didn't have a system to sort out, say, your cutlery or your clothes, it would be chaos. And it's the same thing in our culture and our lives. So in many ways, creating these boxes is a very good thing. Having silos in the sense of specialist units is essential for any modern company or institution. And if you think back to Adam Smith, that great founder of modern economics, he used to say that a division of labour, where essentially you have specialist people doing different things, can make a society much more efficient. The problem comes when those boxes become so rigid and so competitive that they breed tunnel vision. Or else when a society creates a sense of order and structure which was well suited to the world as it existed, say, a century ago, but hasn't moved on as the world around it changes.
So how do you spot them, and then how do you fix them? Second question probably being harder.
Well, there are all kinds of management techniques you can use to try and break down silos in a company. And I tell the story of, say, Facebook as one example of this. And what they've essentially done is to say, yes, we need dedicated specialist teams to write code, but we need to make sure those coding teams don't become rival tribes that all go out and try and compete with each other and withhold information. So they deliberately switch people around between teams a lot. They take people out of their normal teams and make them collaborate with other people, say, once a month. They create a lot of social ties and networks that cut across the teams. They use architecture to get people to bump into each other. So there's lots of techniques you can use.
I mean, some of this sounds kind of hammy.
It sounds very hammy, but I would argue the most important thing of all about trying to master silos is actually to use what sits between your ears, i.e. your brain, and to start off noticing that the way we classify the world, which most of us frankly never think about at all, is quite fundamental to how we think and live and act. And yet, here's a key point. There's more than one way to classify the world. You don't have to be locked into the system or the cultural assumptions that you absorbed from your environment. We don't have to be blind creatures of our own environment, because you can look at your boundaries and borders and say, well, this one works, but this one doesn't. Or let's look at what lies outside our boxes and doesn't quite fit into our neat classification system for the world. Because often the things that fall between the cracks or sit just outside our mental boundaries are not only the most dangerous things, in that can be where risks lie, but it can also be the most interesting things if you're looking to be innovative and creative.
In that vein, what have you learned about yourself writing this?
that I tend to be rather lazy about my own Twitter feed, to be honest.
Really?
I have, you know, when I started thinking about, well, how much of a social ghetto am I falling into? The reality is I naturally tend to follow people like me. I'm trying to change that, but it's hard. I've realized that I tend to naturally create the kind of teams that I inherit. Journalists very easily create departments that were great for covering the world that existed, say, 10 years ago, but it's very hard to change those teams as the world and the story changes, because then you start to threaten power structures. So I'll take a small example. How do we cover fintech, the blend that's going on between the internet, digital companies, and finance? It's a big question, because yeah. It's a hot issue right now in financial reporting. And the reality is that, you know, we've traditionally had a financial services team who write about banks. We have an economics team who write about money. And then we have a technology team who write about all those whizzy gadgets. But these days, the story cuts across boundaries. We're lucky enough on the FT to have a fairly fluid structure. But even so, having to rethink constantly how you organize yourself is absolutely critical. And to my mind, the definition of great journalism is when you really do start to jump across boundaries and silo bust and make people look at the world afresh and not just in their familiar patterns.
Gillian Tett, columnist and U.S. managing editor at the Financial Times, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're going to look forward to next week now. It could be a big one for the global economy. The Federal Reserve Board meets on Wednesday and Thursday and may be on the edge of raising interest rates for the first time since 2006. A pretty historic border. To explain, we have Patty Hirsch. He is our resident explainer and host of the online series The Whiteboard. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Lizzie.
Explain to me why this Fed meeting might be a little bit different, that we might be entering a new, to stick with our theme, border crossing era here.
Well, it's different because if you are a young person who has been used to these very low interest rates that we've had since 2008, then life is about to change for you because your interest rates could start to go up. You know, if the Fed does decide to change the federal funds target rate and try to inch interest rates maybe a quarter point higher, that is going to impact you as a borrower. It's going to make the cost of everything that you borrow, whether it's a student loan or a credit card debt, or if you want to get a mortgage to buy a house or a loan to buy a car, those things are going to get more expensive. And that, for younger people who've never known anything but these low interest rates, will be a very big change.
So what do you think we're going to hear from the Fed? People are going to be analyzing what they do and also what they say.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. I mean, the Fed could do a number of things. It could make an emphatic statement that they're not going to raise interest rates at this point because, you know, we've had these kind of reverberations in the global economy and in stock markets. I think that's unlikely. They could sort of do the old hedging thing where they say, well, we're just going to keep a close eye on things and just wait and see, which could sort of kick the can down the road to the next meeting in the following quarter. Or they could say that, you know, the prevailing conditions in the markets and the global economy right now warrant a slight increase in the rate. So they will raise that target rate. So we could go either way. People will be listening very, very closely to what Janet Yellen says when she makes whatever announcement she makes.
I'm curious how much wiggle room the Fed is putting in here right now about the conditions of the economy and what we'll be able to read based on what kind of language they use.
I think the Fed's going to be very, very careful. Janet Yellen is going to be very, very careful about the way that she phrases this, whichever way it goes, because she wants to give herself the ability to, if she has to, pull back on something. I mean, say, for example, she does decide to increase the federal funds target rate. She may say, well, you know, we're going to be keeping a very close eye on the economy just to see what happens here. And she'll basically give herself the option to come out of it. If she sits on the fence and says, you know, we're going to be watching to see what happens in the economy, because even though unemployment is was coming down. We still know there were some wrinkles there with the unemployment number. And also the inflation rate, which they've been looking for, that 2% rate, they're still not there. So they still want to give themselves the ability to change course if they have to. And in fact, that's really the language that we've been hearing from Yellen over the last year. In fact, ever since she was appointed, is, you know, she's been saying, this is all wait and see. We're taking the temperature of the economy all the time. We're being very, very careful. And in order to make sure that if we do something, that we're not overreacting. And I think that if they do something, they're going to, as I say, hold on to that option to dial it back and make that very, very plain in the language.
And we focus so much on the federal funds rate, but I want you to walk through how that rate ripples out in the banking system and in the rest of the economy.
Okay, so the federal funds rate is the cost that banks pay for money, because banks are lending money to each other all the time, right? And then they're lending that money out. The fact is that banks have a liquidity problem. They're not flush with money sitting in a vault all the time. They can just lend out all the time to run their operations and to do their work. They actually have to borrow from each other. And this is a very common part of the banking system, although not many people know that much about it. Anyway, the cost of actually lending to each other is the federal funds rate. So it's the base cost of money for a bank. Now, banks want to make money, obviously, by lending money out. So any increase in the interest rate that they make, which they have to do to make money, is based off that base rate, off that federal funds rate. So if the federal funds rate increases by 0.25%, it's going to march higher and higher up through the system as they sort of lend to institutions and all the rest of it. And then eventually they lend to businesses, and then eventually they lend to consumers, which tend to be the highest rates that are out there.
One of the things you and I have talked about is the Fed's balance between reining back some credit and yet also watching what's been happening overseas, China, and the sort of global economic temperature. When we talk about rate raises, what kind of increments are we talking about? These are pretty little, right?
Yeah, these are very small. I mean, right now, the federal funds rate, or the target rate, right, which the Fed sets, is between 0.25%. And federal funds rate has been in that area. It sometimes ticks a little higher than that. We're talking about a quarter point increase. So we're talking about, you know, maybe the federal funds target rate might be between 0.25% and 0.5%. It's still very, very little. All right. But it does impact consumers, because regardless of how small that is, how low that is, if it increases, even incrementally, it is going to shut some borrowers out of the market. And the problem is, if it does that, then there's a worry that if those borrowers are shut out and they can't borrow, there's going to be less spending in the economy and the economy might shrink. It also means, of course, that there's less ability for investors to borrow, because investors borrow all the time in order to buy assets, both in the US, and those include homes and stocks and all the rest of it, and around the world. So there's less money sloshing about that can be invested in other things. And so people who look at these things worry that any increase at all will impact the global economy, which then, of course, turns around in a spiral effect and impacts the US economy again.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Like Patty mentioned, even if you don't realize it, things like monetary policy and currency rates have a big role in our everyday lives. And that's playing out right now on the northern border between Canada and Vermont, a place that depends on tourism across the border. Here's part of a Vermont ad to lure tourists.
Vermont. So close. So good.
But right now, the Canadian dollar is so weak that it was worth about 75 American cents at one point this week. That low number is bad news if you need Canadian tourists, but can be nice for Canadian businesses who want Americans to head over. Molly Walsh lives in Vermont, and she's a staff writer for 7 Days, a weekly newspaper in the state. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You have spoken to business owners in Newport, Vermont, near the Canadian border. And what did they tell you about the falling Canadian dollar and what's happening to their businesses?
They're worried. They're concerned. In these small rural towns that are just a few miles south of Canada, the Canadian traffic is very important. And when fewer people come, or people come and don't spend as much money, they notice. So businesses were talking about strategies to try and continue to bring Canadians down And they were also, unfortunately, in their eyes, having to discontinue some of the perks they'd offered to Canadian shoppers in the past.
Really? Like what?
Some of the stores in Newport and other communities have for a long time accepted the Canadian dollar at par. So if you were Canadian, you could pull out your Canadian dollar and buy your American milk without exchanging your money. Mm-hmm. And businesses did this as a way to reach out to the Canadian traffic, give them a little perk, and hope that the volume they would do from Canadian visitors would make up for what has essentially been a discount in recent years. But a couple of the merchants that I spoke with said, you know, we just can't afford to do it anymore. You know, when the Canadian dollar's only worth 75, 80 cents in U.S. money, it just gets to be too deep of a discount.
What kind of businesses really rely on Canadian shoppers, and who's been hit the hardest, do you think?
Well, I think restaurants and hotels and small gift shops rely quite a bit on Canadian traffic, especially along the border, where you have lakes and second homes and lots of activities for tourists to do. So some of the somewhat discretionary spending that Canadians could do is probably a place where they can cut back. So those businesses, some of them were concerned. On the other hand, you have some major resorts that don't seem very concerned and say their Canadian traffic is just fine. We have a large ski area called Jay Peak, very close to the Canadian border, and Jay Peak has for a long time accepted the Canadian dollar at par, and the resort continues to do so for golf in the summer and lift tickets in the winter, and passes to a large water park. And the resort's philosophy is, you know, they're probably 50% of our business, so, you know, we're going to stay loyal to them and keep this policy in effect.
Have you seen this go the other way? I mean, are there people on the Vermont side saying, hey, let's all go to Canada now and take advantage of a strong U.S. dollar?
On some levels, you know, people I've interviewed have said to me, gee, I'm seeing more of the green Vermont license plates on the cars in our parking lots up here in Quebec. And personally, I was in Canada over the long weekend, and gee, it was great to go to a restaurant and get a 25 or 30% discount.
yeah.
But I also know from talking with some of our state tourism officials that they're still not terribly worried about the impact of the dollar. They feel that for the first half of the year, the state's rooms and meals taxes were steady. They feel there are some dips in visits at visitor centers here and there, but overall, those are steady. And they're watching carefully, but they're not terribly worried. And I did notice as I was returning to the U.S. from Canada, there was no line to get back into the U.S. at the border station, and there was a very long line for the Canadians in the cars lined up trying to get back into Canada. Hmm. So, you know, Vermont and New England are still seeing a healthy level of Canadian tourism despite the weak dollar.
Molly Walsh is a staff writer for Vermont 7 Days, a weekly newspaper. Thank you so much, Molly.
My pleasure.
Now we're going to go south to the Mexican border. News stories there often center on violence and immigration. German photographer Stefan Falke wanted to create a different project. So for 7 years, he's been photographing artists on both sides of the border and has formed close bonds with his subjects like Azul Monraz. She's the front singer of Madame Ur y Sus Hombres, a popular band in Tijuana.
Man, it's such a small world.
and you can hear the influence the border has on her life and art.
I didn't like my city when I was young. I used to live just in front of the border. We used to go to the higher place in the house to see the things that people did to cross the border. Then when I grow up and when I start to go out of Tijuana, I start to like my city and start to see the beautiful part of it. The beauty of Tijuana, it's a place made for opportunities to others, and that always brings a dream of better life for people in my country.
To understand the border art scene and how you create a market in an often unstable environment, Stefan Falke joins me now. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When I look at your photographs, you know, some of them were talking about visual artists, but it's a much broader range. What kind of work did you see? And were there through lines, do you think, that ran through it that speak to life on a border?
Interestingly, many artists use either the violence or the border itself or the illegal immigration and so on, or political issues. They're plentiful there. They use them in their art, but many, many do not at all, especially the young ones. They just, you know, they're so tired of seeing and hearing any of that that they just go ahead and they kind of fight everything with color and humor, and it's really refreshing to see.
Can they make a living?
No, none of them. I mean, I would say 98% of artists on the border have a real hard time making a living with it.
Why is that?
There's really no marketplace. I mean, Mexico City is the main place in Mexico, and in the U.S. it's New York or Los Angeles or other cities, but definitely not anything near the border, although, you know, San Diego and El Paso and other bigger cities have an art marketplace, but not on the Mexican side of the border.
When you think about the economics of that region, and I realize we're talking about, I mean, you went on a
miles,
huge yeah. stretch, 2,000 miles. Yeah. How do you think the presence of the border and interacting with it, how does that change the economic life of the people who you talk to?
Well, it's kind of strange. It attracts a lot of economic life because there's a lot of business to be done there because there's so many people, especially in Baja California and Juarez. And you know, there's millions, literally millions of people. So there's a lot of business to be done for certain businesses.
Thinking about the artists who you talked to and interviewed and photographed, what will they do now? What is the sort of trajectory for them look like in the future?
Things have gotten better, and I would say a market is kind of being created. Things seem to be a little better, and people start to take notice because there's an incredible talent along the border and on you know, wherever you go, really, especially in Tijuana, which is like, I would say, the epicenter of
what kind of work?
Any kind of work. Music, a lot of fresh, young music, a lot of murals. I mean, Mexicans love the murals, right? So there's a lot of artists, which is, by the way, really interesting because lots of artists share their murals. They're not in it to create their own profile and get big with that, but they, you know, they're in groups and they really don't care about their own ego and their artwork. That's really good to see. And anything from painting to rap to name it. I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of talent there, which is untapped, I would say. And I would say that cities like Los Angeles take note, Mexico City too a little bit. Some of the artists are starting to float around. We had a very successful exhibition in Germany with five of those artists from the border. So this project already is starting to, that's part of my, you know, that's what I love to see, right?
Stefan Falke, thank you so much for talking with me.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, to see some of Stefan's photographs of his time at the border.
Okay, I'm not saying that you're all the same. Okay, you're not equal, you came in different shapes. So stop crying and do your part. So stop.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're figuring it out. I mean, not the show, but the solutions, sometimes cobbled together, that people use to get by. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Noren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.